Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everybody, my name is Jim Croxton, CEO of Bigger, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. Today, in partnership with our friends at the European Institute for Golf Course Architects, we bring together a panel of four highly experienced architects who will be discussing the effects of the COVID-19 crisis on their part of the industry for current and planned projects and for future work. They'll also discuss whether there's any opportunities post-COVID-19 to focus on golf course presentation, redefining golfers' expectations and how golf courses may actually adapt post-lockdown, especially now that, as of yesterday, some of our golf courses in England are now actually open. Our panellists are Tim Lobb from Lobb & Partners, Paul Kimber from Kimber Glen, James Edwards from EDI Golf Limited, and Gareth Williams from Faudo Design. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Perhaps we'll start with some brief introductions. Tim, would you mind a little bit about yourself and your career?
Thank you, Jim, and thanks for the kind invite to join this session with Bigger. My name is Tim Lobb, and I'm an Australian living in the UK for half of my life. As Jim said, our company is called Lobb & Partners, and we're based in Woking, Surrey. I've been fortunate enough to spend all of my working life as a golf course designer, starting in Australia and then working in Malaysia and Asia, and then coming to Europe, working with European Golf Design for a number of years before setting up with Peter Thompson for Thompson, Perrott & Lobb, which we ran for 12 years until 2016. So... I've travelled a few miles and enjoyed myself and enjoy working on existing golf courses as well as designing new golf courses. So I think we'll leave it at that for the moment.
Thanks, Tim. Next to you, Paul, please.
Hi, yeah, Paul Kimber. Been in the design business for a frightening number of years now. Started off doing landscape work straight out of uni, but then got the opportunity fairly quickly to work with, to join David Kidd, and spent 9 years with him, which was a great education. All of that was on new courses, and built the last sort of three in Scotland back to back. I wouldn't say quite on my own, but I was certainly in charge of three constructions at one point simultaneously, the Castle Course, Mac Dunes and G West. After G West, I set up on my own and was joined fairly quickly by Neil Glenn, who's now a business partner of mine. And we are based in central Scotland, working Scotland, UK and abroad on new projects. I think I'll let that move on from there.
Okay, we may discuss your most recent project as the webinar goes on. Great. James, on to you.
Thanks for letting me follow these two, Jim. Cheers. Yeah, my name's James Edwards. I've been designing for 20 years. Spent the first 10 with Howard Swan, having travelled with, 25 different countries with Howard and his team, which was an excellent, like Paul, an excellent education. The last 10 years has been my own business following the recession, unfortunately, where I set up my own business, EDI Golf Limited. Been specialising in the shorter version of the game, mainly, and enjoying renovation work all throughout this country, mainly. That's basically me in a nutshell. So thank you, Jim.
Thanks, James. And then finally, last but not least, Gareth, tell us a bit about you and Faudo Design.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm Gareth Williams. I've been with Faudo Design since, I think, 2006. I studied landscape architecture at university and managed to very quickly get a job at Faudo as a CAD guy, and I've been there ever since, and I've learned the game there really from, you know, various different architects and from Nick himself. I mean, my experience has been largely abroad really, but with the recession, you know, like all the others, their projects have been reasonably hard to come by. So my career has basically coincided with 2008 recession and what's likely to come. So I've had a fairly broad range of experience from, you know, detailed design through to marketing, through to, you know, all sorts. You know, with Fabric Design, we have to manage the brand as well. So that's fallen partly on my shoulders. Whilst we haven't necessarily had detailed golf design work to be getting on with. So yeah, my experience is fairly broad and not just necessarily golf course design. But yeah, we work largely internationally. We've got a couple of potential projects in the UK, but our focus is largely abroad.
Super, thanks, Gareth. And we'll perhaps come back a little bit to the whole sort of Faldo situation and how it works with your company a bit later on. I want to kick off really by asking about the sort of the obvious question, really, the impact of the crisis we're going through. I mentioned that that golf has opened in England and is due to open in Wales. But Paul, I'm going to come to you first because your probably most famous project right at the moment, not far from St Andrews, I guess is due to open in the next day or two. But with golf being closed in Scotland, that must have presented you some problems.
Yeah, it's not ideal, obviously, to have a course opening. I did think, I mean, the whole project was blessed with good fortune, shall we say, from the moment that they got the money together from the investors to get things in the ground and get it built. It was, as I mentioned in my talk at Harrogate, it was kind of done a bit backwards in terms of the investors' approach, but in terms of they wanted to raise all the money for the development before they started anything, whereas normally you'd get the seed capital and get planning done and then sell that idea. So Clive Clark, whose idea it was and it's his brainchild, wanted, you know, once he had the money, he was desperate to get this thing done unbelievably quickly, which it took an awful lot of stars aligning for it to happen. We started in September 17. And here we are having had a full year and a half of growing, and it is more than ready to open on next week. But finally, the stars didn't align, and something like this, which could never have been predicted, comes in. And all we can do is wait for the government. The course is ready. Keep the course ready and wait for the restrictions to lift in Scotland, and hopefully lift to the extent that we can get some international travel, because that's obviously the main focus of that part of the business. That's what we need, and that's what the other golf courses around it that it will feed from initially need as well.
And we're talking about Dumbarney Links. For anybody listening that isn't aware, I think it's been pretty widely trailed already. And I know I spoke to Graham, the course manager and sort of project leader there in recent weeks, because the last few weeks of a growing is not the ideal time for the industry to decide that only essential maintenance practices with reduced teams was required. But I know he worked within that, and I think he's ready to go if the nod comes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. We've got an announcement supposed to be from Ms. Sturgeon this weekend. So yes. we don't know, but we're keeping our fingers crossed. And maybe the luck will finally really come through at the last minute, but yeah. It's obviously affected bookings and everything like that. But for me, as an architect's point of view, if I can have a slow start, then actually it's not a bad thing, especially if, you know, the initial feedback has all been positive, which is always nice to hear. But if it can have a slow start rather than just have be absolutely stacked from day one, then from very selfishly, from an architect's point of view, it's a good thing, but not for necessarily for an investor.
Yeah. And Tim, turn to you with your role both as an architect, but also on the council of the Institute of Architects. How is this this current crisis here in the UK and further afield, I guess, affecting kind of the architecture industry, and then perhaps Lobham and Partners themselves?
That's a good question, Jim. We in the Institute have been trying to run some communication programs like this one that you're doing with your members, and trying to get a gauge of the market across Europe. And it's sort of been broken up into a few segments in terms of golf courses. We obviously have members golf courses, which are coming back online now, and obviously play is going to be strong. And then we have tourism golf, which a lot of us are involved with when we design new courses, which are really going to be struggling because, you know, obviously travel and hotel occupancy is way down. So obviously the locations in southern Spain, and we've been working in Turkey and Egypt, pretty much a year is a write-off, I think. In terms of the European scene, we're hearing, you know, like in England, golf is popular and getting some new golfers out there, which is really exciting for our industry. Where our industry sits at the moment, I guess it's quite tricky because, you know, some of the major projects that people are involved with are still going forward, but it's difficult to travel to get to them, which is obviously making life difficult. But the design work, we have a few projects where we can continue the design work from our office, our home office, and obviously communicate like this, which is wonderful. It's really opened up our eyes on the way of working, I think, and, you know, creating concepts and ideas on a screen miles apart is something that's happening regularly now. So we can work. I guess the new projects are years worth of work with the work that we do to golf clubs, existing golf clubs in our area. I guess the timing was good that all the construction work had finished, more or less, you know, leading into spring. So in terms of the local scene, it didn't really affect because most of the work was done at that time. So but for our firm, we have a couple of sort of large long-term jobs which are continuing on, which is fine. We've got two nice jobs to announce as soon as the time is appropriate, which will be great as well. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's been the best year ever, but it's not a catastrophic one.
And how about you, Gareth? What do you think is the sort of the main impact of these last few months and maybe the next few months on your organisation?
I mean, similar to Tim there, I think, you know, there's a few projects or a couple of major projects we've got in construction internationally, and they've definitely been affected. You know, there's been a slowdown, but as they open up, I imagine they'll, you know, they'll pick up the pace again. I mean, it's difficult to know. I think regionally, the virus is affected at different rates, and so different regions will open up at different paces. But we're hopeful that the projects that are going now will continue, and you know, won't see a huge amount of delay. I mean, let's say 6 months or so, but in the scheme of a new project, that's not really that much. I think the newer projects, that's time will tell on those, really. There's a few we've been in discussion with, and whilst some have continued discussion, others have, you know, completely stopped all conversation because, I mean, we were talking to a potential client in France, and I sent him an email probably in the week where everything really kicked off in France, and it was a complete shutdown, nothing's happening. I mean, they were in fairly key period in discussion with the authorities, and of course everyone locked down, so nothing happened. And I haven't heard back yet, so I need to get back in touch with them. It's difficult to say at the moment. I mean, I suppose every project's different. And this is talking new projects. I think renovations, I mean, the guys probably would have a slightly better view on it than me, but, you know, I think there are opportunities for renovations, perhaps smaller ones to start with. It depends on how many people are able to get to site. But, you know, like Tim, from a working point of view, we sort of managed to arrange ourselves so we had all the kit and plans and everything necessary we needed in our homes to be able to just get on with the work. So having video conference capability has just meant we can carry on as normal. We're very used to working internationally, so it's always remote anyway until we actually get to site. The one thing we're lacking is being able to go to site, which certainly is problematic. We're coming across issues where we can't actually go and see what's on the ground. But nonetheless, there are people on the ground, so we're finding shortcuts. Whether that's using drones, we've certainly done that on a couple of the projects. But just having photos, even on a daily basis, if that's possible. The last few weeks that hasn't been possible, but I'm sure that will come. So working at home is very doable.
James, I left you to last for a reason. In terms of, and I want to sort of focus a little bit on as you mentioned in your intro, your sort of specialty in recent times has been, as you say, the sort of shorter forms of the game and the academy side and whatever else. So do you see any sort of marked difference in how this is impacting on that side of the industry? Is it generally the same, or will it make things better or worse particularly?
No, I think it's huge. I think the other three guys on this chat as well have these discussions going on. So you couldn't have picked three guys who I know are also in this space doing a similar thing. Gareth and I have even shared plans or looked at ideas just from other things. I know Tim and I have, and Paul, I haven't done this yet. But the reality is that all of us are absolutely in this space. Even if they don't per se specialise in it, we're all being asked to do it. And there's a reason for that, and that is because the industry is crying out now, in my opinion, for this 1 hour, 1.5 hour exercise. And what I'm finding is my phone is off. It's literally ringing off the hook from developers and from golf clubs wanting to downsize. And that is literally north to south, south to north, whatever you want to say. It's across the country. So from my perspective, my business is busy. I hate to say that on a phone call like this, but I should be proud of it, because that's the way we set our business up. And I'm quite pleased that we never focused entirely on new build projects in beautiful places, but I would like to have some. So if anyone's listening and they want to give me a project, that's absolutely great. But right now what I'm finding is that a developer A is phoning up and saying, we had one yesterday who said, we're going to reduce 18 holes down to 9-hole par 3. The other part of the course is going to turn into other amenity, cycle tracks, farm shops, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of maybe 50, 60 homes, and that's what's happening now. It's turning into, or these spaces are under threat, as everybody knows from my mantra, is that golf courses are under attack from developers. Golf clubs are looking at it as viable options as an out, or almost like an out game. They're now looking at it as potentially, right, can we potentially now amalgamate with another course and go over there, and we'll sell off this land. And then I think all of us know of those discussions that are going on up and down the country. Without sounding like a magpie, that the reality is that's happening. And the architects on this chat, particularly another architects who have set their business up to go for that type of carrot, are going to win. And I hate to use that terminology, because there's a lot of stuff happening in this industry where we have to be, or where we all have to pull together and make sure that we're all winning. But at this moment, development is happening and job security will happen. I think it's just a case of making sure that these courses are viable, so that they don't just, without going over other questions you've got here, that courses are viable, which still require bigger and all of the excellence behind bigger and all the members, apart from it just shutting down and becoming nothing. So in my opinion, things are actually going to work out for the better.
Interesting. And to clarify, is your phone ringing even during the crisis? Not, or is it because of the crisis, or is it already a kind of a movement?
Before this crisis happened, I stood on a stage with Paul earlier this year, and I said, I came up with a percentage which was then reported of how many courses I thought was going to shut. That was prior to COVID. Or not prior, that's a lie. It was happening in other parts of the world, but in our country, as we all know, without going into politics, it wasn't necessarily front page news. So I had that in my head that things were going to happen for golf anyway, just because I just believed that 18 hole courses up and down the country and members clubs up and down the country were not responding. I personally believe it's like the high street. I always relate it to high streets. All of us on this call used to go and stand in high streets and go and shop in high streets. Now we don't. Now we go to shopping centres. And the reason why that happens is because it's now, we all need to have that time efficient 1 hour, 2 hours. So we park the car close to where we need to play. We play, we go home. High streets, you know, and that's my kind of analogy, that, and high streets have died on the back of it. And the golf courses will do the same if we do not change the way that they are, almost the way they are offered to a member, whether it's the membership itself or the PR behind it, whatever it is, we need to change something, because some clubs are strong, other clubs are weak. It's a very general comment, but in my eyes, from all my clients that are phoning up and asking me questions, they're scared about money coming in, quite frankly, and they're looking for exit strategies of how to put how to put food on the table. They're looking at, like, if they need a reservoir, if they need, how are they going to raise that 100 grand? And a lot of clubs have it, a lot of clubs don't. And that, so my job at the minute is very much like, James, can you please raise for us, please, £250,000? We need to do some jobs. And the way you do that, fortunately, is by maybe looking at some land regeneration or land remaster planning. And that's not a dirty word. It happens beautifully in other parts of this country. And I see a lot of clubs have sold off portions of land and created a better facility. So the phone is ringing also in COVID. Because now you've got the clubs, the distressed clubs that need to look at things differently. And you've also got the clubs that are forward thinking and have some money in the bank who want to improve. And that's why it's quite exciting for architecture, whether if you've set your business up correct. If you haven't, then you could be struggling.
I think that's the point, is that it can be exciting. There are opportunities out there. You know, there are many clubs that have multifunction facilities available to their members or guests, and there are many that don't. And those that don't could. And it's about planning. It's probably jumping ahead a bit to one of your last questions, but that's certainly one of the things I think architects can offer, is the ability to help a club plan on the basis of who they're trying to offer to their members, new members, try and draw people, new visitors in, you know, and it can be exciting. It's a difficult time, and has been since, you know, 2008 or beforehand, and certainly during this period. But yeah, I agree with James. There are the opportunities there.
But it's important also to point out, Jim, that we're not going in and advising that courses do this. This is what clubs are coming to us first and asking for the exit strategy. Like, what can we do? I'm not going in there and proposing that we should build, that we should reform the club into something. I would never do that. It's more a case of, if a club approaches us and says we need to think differently, then that's absolutely our discussion. But I wouldn't go in there and propose to reduce an 18-hole golf course unless they needed to.
I think I'll come to Tim and Paul next on this question. I'd like to just wait a couple of minutes before we get into, you know, how golf may change, because I think there's a lot around that, and that some of that is business and some of that is going to be people's preferences and customer preferences and also demand. But I'm curious at the moment if any of you guys have got kind of ongoing projects, sort of renovations, refurbishments, that kind of thing. Do you see this crisis beyond the obvious, you know, people might have a bit less money and might stall on projects. Do you see it having an impact on those in people sort of changing their plans midstream? Perhaps go with you, Paul, first. It's a while since we heard from you.
Yeah, we've had a couple of projects which have paused due to COVID. That's clubs that, really ones that are right at the beginning, who just don't know where things sit. But as James was alluding to, those are clubs who are trying to find a way to raise money anyway. So this is only going to enhance that as we see it. So we do really only see those as paused. We're halfway through a renovation work at Lady Bank, and they have confirmed that they still want to go ahead this winter, which It's obviously good for us, and it's good for the club. It sends out the right message. Really, I think the financial crash was the first wake-up call for golf clubs, and that they need to be run much more as a business than they were or have been traditionally. And those that survived that, but are on a shaky footing, if they didn't make a plan for the future, then they should have done. And now, really, now's when they could be in trouble, but they will have to make a plan for the future. They've got to work out what their audience is, what their market is, and target that market. Whatever that is, whether it's as a traditional club or as something new, people will still want to play golf. Golf is one of the few sports that you can do socially distant, incredibly distant if you've got my drives. But you can, it's one of those sports that people are back playing. But we've got to take advantage of that. And the danger is that the upsurge that we may get in the short term is lost. Clubs really need to do things that they can to hang on to any new golfers that do come in. I think there's a short window now for golf clubs to take advantage of what is actually an opportunity.
Yeah, I know. And before I come to you, Tim, one of the things that we've been trying to urge our members to do over the last few weeks, and I know the industry urging golf clubs, and this is in the UK predominantly, but it's very rare we get a period of time when we're not suddenly rushed off our feet and we can actually sort of think about the future. And I know a lot of golf clubs have done some real soul searching over this last couple of months in their moments of downtime to think, what business do we want to be when we come out of this? You know, what is the right model for us, and what is ultimately what is the right golf course, which clearly impacts on you guys. So Tim, I'm going to ask you to get the crystal ball out a little bit in terms of any sort of ongoing work that you're doing and whether you think that might change, but also what do you think the kind of the next wave of work could be? Is that going to be as sort of as James is suggesting, you know, repurposing facilities, or could there be other things as well?
I certainly think what James is saying is 100% going to be a something to pursue. So yeah, that will be, I think, just the natural market forces happening there. And I think a good point was that, you know, the new golfers that do come in, we've got to make sure we cater for it. Something we've been talking about in our institute the last 3 or 4 weeks on our weekly seminars are what facilities should be produced in the future. We're helping to design facilities for the future and trying to determine what that future should look like is a difficult question to answer. But in terms of the demand for golf, we've got a chance now to latch onto this opportunity. I know your members have done an amazing job to get the courses, first of all, keeping them going with low staff numbers, but now when they're reopened to satisfy the golfers' expectations, it'll be interesting to see, you know, demand might be driven by a change in golfer expectations and golfer ideals. And hopefully they won't be, you know, overly concerned if a green is running half a foot slower than it was yesterday or other matters, and think about the bigger picture. So in terms of the crystal ball, I guess each club or each golf facility has got to really determine who their market is and be very focused in on producing the facilities and making sure that they deliver on that. Whether it's a club, you know, a pay and play is a different model, a resort play, you know, tourism golf is a different matter, you know, altogether.
And in terms of this crystal ball, it's pretty difficult because we still don't know what's going to happen in the short term, let alone beyond that. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of golf clubs open in the initial sort of period, 9 holes only, because of demand, you know, trying to get people out on the golf course. James has already mentioned the idea of limited time. Potentially as well, people, the situation in Ireland is going to be that people can only travel in the first phase up to 5 kilometres, 3 miles from their home to play golf, which is going to be pretty bad news for rural golf courses and make some of the city ones incredibly, incredibly busy. But do you see the golf industry responding? I'll come back to you, Gareth, on this in terms of, you know, looking at ways that they can provide a different product, which obviously would involve, you know, architects to be part of that.
Yeah, I do actually. You know, for a long time, and James and I have talked late into the night about this many times. I'm a big believer in shorter forms of the game. And, you know, fundamentally that comes back to the fact that the game needs to be fun. You know, as I said earlier, I've had the fortune or misfortune to have a career that's basically been within some form of downturn. And so I think in our office, we've always tried to look at ways in which we can adapt and be innovative. And, you know, I've talked to Nick about this a lot as well, and he's a big believer in shorter forms of the game as well. And, you know, just talking about renovations in terms of being innovative, and, you know, the work that we've done on new projects, we've tried to incorporate different kinds of facilities into those new projects. And I think that can absolutely apply to renovations as well. Whether that goes down from 18 holes to 9 holes plus a par three, or if there's extra land, adding a Himalayas putting green, for example. You know, I know Nick's a big fan of those sorts of things, par three courses. It's just about being slightly innovative, and if the game can be more attractive to a wider group of players, bringing new players in, whether that's bringing in technology, you know, on the range, bringing in some sort of ball finding technology, or you know, TrackMan or anything like that. Obviously, those are expensive versions, but there are cheaper versions as well. You suddenly start looking at different groups that might come into the club and be retained in the club. You know, we've got this short period, as Paul mentioned, where chances are there's going to be new faces at golf clubs. And if there's a way to keep them in there once things open up a bit, then, you know, the golf's been searching for those people for 10 or 15 years. Suddenly we've got this period where it's being forced upon us, and there's the chance to take advantage of it. You know, so the answer is, yeah, I think innovation is the key here.
Thanks, Gareth. And I was going to ask, and Gerald, I think all the questions kind of to an extent merging into one. And you know, I think we can all assume that, you know, golf clubs are, as a rule, going to be in a different financial position than they were expecting, and not in a good way, for the next 12 months or so at least. And so, you know, they're going to be looking for, you know, a way to business improve. And some of that, as James has pointed out, I think could be around, you know, releasing land to create cash or to find a whole new sort of customer. But are there other ways in which architects can work with a golf club to either improve revenue or potentially save cost? Question open to the floor.
Yeah, I'll have a crack at that. I think most certainly. I mean, I think like anything, when you get a fresh set of eyes on something, it's always interesting and enlightening. And we are certainly not greenkeepers or experts in the field that your members undertake. But a lot of the time, some of the activities we can do to help golf clubs are helping with the landscape treatment, I think, is number one very important topic. I mean, we've been working on a lot of the Heathland courses down in Surrey and Berkshire, and certainly working on the Heathland strategy for the clubs, which in the long term is going to be a benefit for the maintenance, but also for the integrity of the golf course. And also mowing lines, something we're looking at. I know all your members will know the efficiencies of various mowers and how to save time, but maybe not taking a really hard look at where the mowing lines impact on the strategy of the golf. So I think it's a nice blend between thinking about design and thinking about maintenance together. And you know, even on the smaller scale, I think the input of a golf course architect can really help bounce some ideas together. So that's another way I think that hopefully that our industries could work together a bit more and just bounce ideas off each other in that regard.
I know that by square meter, bunker maintenance is absurdly expensive for our members. And Gareth, I'm going to come back to you. And this may have been before your time with Faldo, but when I think of Faldo design, I think of Chart Hills, which is a golf course that doesn't lack for sand on it. And I know a lot of work that you guys have done in recent times, a lot of your colleagues has been around sort of bunker renovation, redesign and replanning, but generally speaking, to reduce the amount of sand on the golf course. Do you see that continuing? And can you give us an idea of some of the savings potentially that clubs have received by reducing bunker amounts on golf courses?
Gareth, can I just interrupt that? I was a member.
Yeah, well, you go.
I was a member there for 10 years, and I did 1 year of looking after those bunkers as a greenkeeper in 2000. So I know exactly what Gareth's going to say before I even start on that point. But that's 10 years at Chart Hills raking those bunkers.
Well, it's interesting you bring Chart Hills up. We can't as a firm, we can't get away from Chart Hills because it's the only Faldo course in the UK. If you go to any other Faldo course, it doesn't look like Chart Hills.
No, I'm sure.
We've had every conversation we have in the UK, everyone brings it back to that, unfortunately. It's a great course. Interestingly, we were contacted, or I started working again with them about 6 years ago or so. It's now changed ownership twice since then. But they were looking at doing exactly that. And actually, I can't give you costings, but there were about 120 bunkers, all of which were enormous. And they wanted to take them out. And I was, to be honest, I went down there and I wrote up a plan and worked out which ones we could take out without affecting strategy. I was a bit nervous going to Nick about it. And Nick's reaction is literally his first line was, of course they've got to take them out. It was designed at a different time. You know, it was designed for really high net worth people. And after about 5 years, that was James. And after about 5 years, the market completely changed and the membership changed. And they've done extraordinarily well to keep it going, to be honest. So, you know, we put together a plan to take bunkers out. And actually, in fact, it changed ownership and that didn't happen because new money came in. But yes, I mean, I completely agree. I think that is a trend, absolutely. And, you know, Chart Hills is a special case because of the number of bunkers. But what we did was absolutely retain the strategy of the course, but still take out a lot of sand. Mm-hmm. And that's very possible. You know, it's not all about sand hazards. You know, there are hazards of all sorts, as well as the, you know, current trend for actually opening up courses and adding width, basically. You know, I think going back to the question of, or the idea of golf being fun, you know, actually having wide golf courses adds to that fun. It makes them so much more playable. It doesn't take away from the quality of the course or the strategy. You know, and often membership can be a barrier in that because they see taking bunkers out as you know, degrading the value of a golf hole or a golf course. But, you know, that's, I would argue that's, it's the exact opposite. In terms of costs, I couldn't give you that. I think probably
in terms of costs, I've done some work with Grant Frogley and Lee Strutt when they were at G West. And the work we do wasn't necessarily about making things smaller, but it was about the benefits of adding a liner. And both of them independently came up with the same number of 7 years payback. it's hard to get the cost in sort of pounds, shillings and pence. But in terms of the savings of greenkeepers' time and having liners in the bunkers you do have, if the payback's 7 years, it does show how much it's a big investment for a club to make. But if they, we also did an analysis for another club in Scotland where they were just going to put liners in and not change the amount of sand. And we proved to them that if we put in the bunkers that we thought reduced the amount of sand, actually it was going to cost them no more to reshape them at the same time and get them lined as it would do just to line what they had. So being efficient in the amount of sand is critical. It's hard to actually put a number on the savings, but you do get the payback pretty quickly.
Anybody else want to come in on that point before we move on? James's pen's in the air.
I definitely do, Jim. Sir Jim, I should say. No, I'd solve it by increasing membership money. The clubs in this country are, apart from Surrey, are woefully low. And I'm just doing some maths here just to try and put some points forward to the group and to the people that are listening. £1,500, if that was your membership rate. Now, I know that's not necessarily representative of the Southwest, or if you take a £1,500 club and you've got a gentleman who plays once a week, that's 28 quid a round. That's about right, I think. But this is a members club. But if you've got a guy there who plays five times a week, he's paying £5.75 a round. Now, he's spending, now, in my opinion, for 6 hours of entertainment plus, you should be paying more than 6 quid. And that's my biggest, that's always been my biggest beef with this industry is, I'm a member of a David Lloyd that costs me £200 for me and my other half. So in other words, it's £100 each. And every time I go there, I'll spend £25 on the salmon and whatever as well. And I'm putting money back into that business all the time. And what I don't get with golf is that the people who play the most are the people who take the most. And I've never got that. Then, whereas me, if I play once a fortnight, I'm paying £57 for my round of golf and I've got less rights. And it's kind of this, it's a very strange sort of thing about golf. And I think if we could get more money out of the member who plays more golf than me, then in theory, you could pump all that into the course, you could pump all that into the wages. I really mean that genuinely. If anyone's listening on this call who works in the game, I think they're underpaid. I don't want to relate it to NHS, but underpaid people that need to be paid more, quite frankly. And I think a lot of memberships need to, I go to some clubs in the Southwest who are paying £600 a year. And I think, how does that stack up as a number if I did the
maths? Lots of those in Scotland.
Was that? Yeah.
There's lots of those in Scotland.
Yeah. But how does a club pay their staff? Money.
Unfortunately, they don't. I mean, you're not wrong, and greenkeepers are most undervalued and underpaid professions that there are, and they all love the courses, love the places that they work. It is too cheap for those guys who play 5-6 times a week. They're getting a phenomenal deal. And it comes into my earlier point about the business structure. You know, clubs really need to think about what is the correct business structure. And yes, they may, if clubs can get more money from fewer rounds, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's just putting value back into your club. It's understanding the value of your product. And that's what, as a member, if I was playing at Chart, which I was lucky enough to play at Chart Hills during the glory years, I call it, Gareth, when it was 1996, when all of the best players in the county were there, including the McGurks, the Princes, et cetera, everybody was there. Faldo was there as well. He was there fishing regularly. But the point is for me, the point is that club was, I think I was paying something like £1,200 at the most exclusive club in the area, arguably. And that was an absolute privilege to pay that money as a junior. Now, that's a lot of money, don't get me wrong. I'm not pointing that out. It's more to do with the fact that I spent all day long every day there, which is good value. Because as my mum always said, it's going to cost me twice that to have you at home if I have to take you to swimming baths. And so golf, and that's the best money I'll ever invest in. But in my opinion, to get kids into the game, to get more people playing, we have to change the way the membership is set up. I think the way, and that's why I know a lot of good work's being done by a lot of good management experts. But like Royal Norwich, obviously has Phil Grice has a fantastic system up there. I know that's come off the back of other ideas that are in a similar stratosphere. I know Eddie Bullock and all these guys have been doing similar things for years. But the Goodwood model, but that membership structure works for people like me, quite frankly. And if I could pay my money per round to play a round of golf, and I could invite Paul and Tim and Gareth down, and it was just credits, then I'm going to feel a lot more like I've got value for my one round of golf. And that course should be absolutely excellent because we're paying the correct value for the round of golf. That's my rant over, sorry.
I think this is, one of the things we talked about, the IGCA Clubhouse online meetings, is the idea of a change in attitude, a shift. And, you know, these membership structures, I don't know much about membership structures, but I completely agree with what James says. You know, golf, parts of golf are stuck in the past a bit. And, you know, if you looked at it now, you wouldn't start it as it currently is at most clubs. You know, the membership, you pay one fee and you're a member for a year. It just, the lifestyles have changed. And, you know, I'm a perfect example. Nearly 40, I've got two kids with another one just about to arrive. I don't play golf very much at all.
What moisturizer do you use, Gareth?
Yeah. But I'd love to. I'd love to play the old round. And I'd like to have a home club. But there's no way I can afford that, you know, with paying whatever. You know, I live down the road from Tim. You know, and sorry, the price of golf here is very high. Membership structures are one thing that could really change the game, and that's where this culture shift might be a big thing. You know, and this is the opportunity. It's not just about, you know, changing the physical aspects of golf.
I think it will be, and I think what we will see potentially. I mean, and Paul and James are right. I mean, the variation membership fee around the country is extraordinary, but right now members are grateful for their opportunity in England, certainly because courses have opened, but you know, there's going to be limited green fee revenue and practically zero clubhouse revenue over the next 6 months for most facilities, meaning that the budget's going to be very, very tight. And I think most clubs have been trying to sneak their membership fees up by 1-2% every year and struggling to get that through their AGMs or EGMs. And there will be a reckoning now when actually a club is going to have to come to their membership and say, listen, if you want the product that you've been having in the past, which is unlimited access to your golf club, it's now going to cost you a chunk more, and, you know, and make that decision. I just want to sort of bring it back to architecture as well, if we can. And Gareth talked about fun, and I'll come to you now, Tim. In terms of sort of what does that mean? You know, Gareth sort of talked a little bit about width, and I think, you know, certainly the way I play golf, the wider the fairways and whatever, the better. But how could we look to be bringing more fun into the game at the average golf course?
I think it all starts at the tee. And, I mean, it sounds a very obvious statement, but a lot of the courses that we go and look at, and existing golf courses, I would say, and analyse, the tee locations and the setup of the course is so restrictive for you know, your members. A lot of the times the ladies' tees are too far back, and which makes it restrictive on where the men's tee can go. So it's very difficult to give flexibility in the length of the course. And also, we've had a few sessions on ladies golf with our ERGCA, and certainly the distances and the expected carries, you know, they were talking 70 yards should be a carry for a lady. So I think if you go out and analyse a lot of the courses, and we've done that at a few of the Heathland courses, was to make sure that there was no carry, you know. Well, at that time, I think we had 80 yards because we didn't want to take out heather because the, you know, the ladies or the slower swing golfers couldn't make the carry. So I think it all begins at the tee and having the correct tee. One of the discussions that I think is coming to a fore, it certainly is in Europe, is degendifying tees, which is, I mean, why we call them ladies' tees and men's tees, I'm not sure. So it'll be great if in the UK we get to a stage where a tee is a tee, and you play from the tee of your ability and your swing speed. I think that's going to make a massive difference to golf and to improve the fun or the accessibility to golf, because at the moment it's just totally out of whack, and it's very antiquated the way that courses have to be set up. And this is unfortunately rules that have to be followed, and they need to change. They really need to change, because it's not helping. So I'd say further, extensive consideration on the tee setup is really important to make golf fun, and invest in your tees, because everyone steps on a tee. Where golf balls go after that, who knows? They can go anywhere, and we don't even know if they're going to even finish the hole. But everyone steps onto a tee. So if you're not on the right tee, the right distance, the right angle, it's a very difficult game. So, we spend a lot of time thinking about the design of tees and how they're going to be appropriate for the game. Width, that Gareth said, is really important. I'm a firm believer of the landscape and the natural integrity of the course needs to be, pretty consistent through the golfing journey, and to make sure that the indigenous species is used as much as possible through the course, and try and keep a consistent landscape palette, which is sometimes very difficult when you have tree planting committees and all that type of business. And it's hard for greenkeepers to go to committees and say, this is rubbish, these trees, and it might be somebody's memorial. But it's a lot of the time we hope to offer support to greenkeepers who obviously have the idea, but sometimes it might be difficult to get it over the line. So I think keeping the landscape integrity is really important. And then, bunkering and green design and all that is a whole new matter that maybe one of the other guys can talk about. Tees is a big one for me that I think people really underestimate the importance of that.
Thanks, Tim. I think in all the participation work that we get involved in, everything begins with F, and I'll be careful how I say all these things, but it's fun, it's family, and it's flexibility. And family, I think you're absolutely right in terms of de-gendifying, new word, tees, and having that flexibility on the hole you're playing. I'll perhaps come to Paul next, but in terms of flexibility now, we're seeing nine-hole play become important. James has talked about being able to play for an hour, hour and a half. I saw a lot of social media yesterday from golfers in England loving the fact that they went and played 18 holes and did it in 3 hours because it was two balls and everyone was in, and because they weren't taking the flag out, and I know a lot of golf courses haven't even bothered putting tee markers out. They've just said, walk to the tee, put it down where you like and give it a go. Where does flexibility come in, and how can an architect help with that?
Well, flexibility is obviously key. Like Tim's right, tee position and tee angle as well. I do one thing, go back to when we built the castle course, like the eighth hole there, I think we put in 10 tees, which from a greenkeeper's point of view might be a nightmare, but actually just changing the difficulty with the angle of a tee means, it shouldn't all be about distance, I guess is what we're saying, and carry distances, people have to learn to remove their ego maybe so that they can be more flexible and try the fun approach rather than always just going for distance. And that was one thing that we did at Dumbarney that I strongly disagreed with, was a course that was 7,800 yards long. It was a tee that's way back. And I fought it as hard as I was able, but it was what was demanded of us. And that has gone in. So I'm in a way slightly disappointed by that. But there's all sorts of other ways that, that clubs can be, that the flexibility come needs to come throughout, you know, from the moment you turn up at the golf club to the moment you leave, that whole journey, that whole experience. So how you're able to use the course, yes, is it nine holes? Is it six? You know, if it's a new course, you're trying to get loops that will come back to the clubhouse as often as possible. Not only does that generate retail opportunities, it just gives them operational flexibility as well. So, you know, is there, are people, you know, not frowning on people for jumping ahead and, you know, and just playing a quick six holes if they can? You know, there needs to be common sense applied to that. But breaking down some of these, you know, the stricter rules and taboos in golf would really help it be flexible. And being flexible with your T-shirt. I mean, so many clubs in Scotland are empty on a Sunday afternoon. Let a family go out on a five ball. Why not? You know, let them, if there's 10 groups, a group of 10, if the course is empty, let it happen. You know, managers of clubs, everybody needs to be flexible in every which way. That will help bring the fun element. You know, you go out for a 10 ball and play two holes, but I could see that being fun.
Yeah.
You need to find different ways to use the course and look at when it's empty and get people out there. But they're only going to pay the right amount for that. So it all needs to work together.
That was exactly what I was talking about, the culture shift. You know, just slightly changing the goalposts so that there are the strict guidelines of what we know as normal are changed slightly. So that, you know, you've got 18 holes out there until 8 a.m., the back nine, if it's an 18-hole loop, the back nine's not used. Well, what a waste. You know, go and get some people out there, ship some people out there. Well, you know, whatever. One of the projects we're working on at the moment, it's a new course, but the idea behind it is valid. We're looking at 3 6-hole loops that also has 2 9-hole loops in there. So operationally, you can get 3 tee starts out on during busy periods. You know, one of the things I've been talking with Nick about, you know, I've heard him talk about it on a couple of different podcasts, is just the idea of, you know, opening up a 6-hole loop, as Paul said. You know, if it means getting people through, it's an hour, it's an hour and a half, whatever it is, it also cuts down on, you know, if you're limited on staff, it means you don't have to be maintaining the full 18 holes to the same standard. You know, one day you prepare 6 holes and the next day they're played and the guys can work on the rest of them. You know, it's just about, certainly in this period, it's about that sort of flexibility. I think going forward, you know, and this is teeing up James because I know this is one of his big things, but as Paul said, it's the user experience. It's the customer experience from gate to tee and back to gate. And in terms of fun, just allowing, you know, a little section of the putting green for kids. You know, why not? Why not have a picket fence or a plastic picket fence around it? The parents know where the kids are. They can have a drink on the patio, and the kids can have a go on the putting green.
2 meters apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks, Gareth. And James is currently, albeit interrupted by the COVID crisis, but has been doing a fairly major tour of Bigger's regions with his story of customer journey and flexibility, and probably another topic for another day. An hour has whistled by, gentlemen, which I think is probably a good sign, and we've managed to sort of touch on most of the topics that have come through. So I'm going to just finish with a quick light question for all four of you before we wrap up. And the question's come from one of our members. With the exception of the present company, I guess of your company, which architect's work do you particularly appreciate the most? I'll go back to you, Gareth, and we'll start there.
Oh God.
and if not necessarily an architect, maybe a style of course or whatever else.
Oh well, I mean, I love Lynx Golf, but Heathen Golf is just fantastic. If I could spend my time on a Heathen course, I'd be a happy man. I'm a big Harry Colt fan, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, historically, for me, he's the guy who started everything off, started strategic golf off, you know, and it exploded from there. So I'm a big Colt fan. You know, it helps that some of the nicest courses around are down the road. So occasionally I get to see them. So that would be my answer.
This is like an episode of Pointless. The further down the track it is, the harder to find the easy answer. So, Paul, you get to go next.
Oh, thanks.
Bad news, Tim, you'll be last.
Well, I was just trying to think who I could go with it. I'm glad the question wasn't living, that's for sure.
yeah.
But I'll go with Pete Dye. I think he kind of helped golf architecture be reborn. So, you know, some of the stuff he did was completely out there at the time. So although maybe a lot of the styles are maybe out of fashion now, I think some of the things, it was really innovative and really creative. And what he did on some limited budgets, when you go to Sawgrass and have a look at the stuff there that was done on the shoestring, and the size of the greens and things like that, the limitations he had and what they came up with. So I think, especially in the current times, I think he's quite appropriate as somebody I would go for.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul. James, it looks like you were in agreement with that call. So.
Paul has nailed that, absolutely nailed that. I couldn't agree more. I know there's other people that have done pretty good stuff, but Pete Dye, I was lucky enough to meet him at Kira Island in 2002. And he was just, as you would imagine, just an absolute legend. But his creativity has never been, I don't think, matched. And I think I agree with Paul in the regard that, and I've got to be careful with that comment, but he's the only guy who I know in architecture who has a brand. If you turn up to his course, you know it's a Pete Dye course. I don't know whether any of the other guys can think of anyone else who you could turn up to their course and you can go, he designed that. But it's a very difficult thing for us architects to do, is to come up with a style, because a lot of us don't agree with having a repetitive style. But Pete Dye has managed to create a style which is never boring, no matter what course you go to. But if I have to come up with a separate one, my other artistic hero, so to speak, is a guy who's just, well, not just passed away a few years ago, Mike Strance. And Mike Strance, who is a guy based in the United States, creatively put together one or two of the best golf courses I've ever stepped foot on. Tobacco Road. If any of you are lucky enough to go to Tobacco Road and play a game of golf, that's one trip for you. So, even just to see it,
just the creativity. I've seen plenty of photos. I've never been. It's on my bucket list. But
and I might add, to make his head incredibly big, Paul's work's not bad either.
Fair point. So, Tim, final word to you, an architect you admire the most.
I wanted to go for two, but I wanted to go for living and not living. Harry Colt, like Gareth, we're in good sort of Harry Colt territory around here in Surrey, and some beautiful properties that he laid out, and absolutely beautiful courses. For living, I'll go for Carl Phillips, because I know him quite well, and he's such a lovely guy. But also, I think his courses are visually absolutely beautiful, but very playable. I've really had some nice rounds on some of his courses. King's Barnes and Yas Links in Abu Dhabi is beautiful. So I'll go for Carl, and he's been a nice friend to me, for sure.
Good. Well, thanks, Tim. Thanks, everyone, gentlemen. nice, Tim, you had the final word, in your role on the council of the IGCA. So thanks again to you and your council and Julian and the team for helping us with all the things that we do together. A couple of little plugs at the end. First of all, for bigger members listening live, our members' choice survey to help shape our next annual conference, BTME, is still live, and we very much like your input into the type of learning and the topics of learning that you would like to see take place at that event. And then for details about all of our future webinars, they're taking place on Tuesdays and Thursdays. From here on in, please visit the What's On page of the bigger website. But finally, to Tim, to Paul, to Gareth and James, thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.